to another American Bankruptcy Institute podcast. I'm David Skeel, a former scholar in residence at the ABI. I'll be speaking today with Donald Bernstein of Davis, Polk, and Wardwell. Don is a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School and has been practicing at Davis, Polk for nearly 30 years, more than 20 of those years as a partner. He is one of the leading corporate reorganization lawyers in the country, having represented either a creditor, creditors committee, the debtor, a receiver, or a liquidator in Delphi, Refco, Enron, Conseco, Johns Manville, and just about any other big case you can name. He's currently chair of the National Bankruptcy Conference. He's the author of a very important recent article in the Yale Law Journal with Douglas Baird, and I could go on and on, but I'll stop at that point. Don, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
My first question is kind of goes back to the beginning. Did you go to law school thinking what I want to be in life as a bankruptcy lawyer, and that's how you ended up doing corporate reorganization, or how did you get into this practice?
Well, no, I didn't start law school having any thought of going into a corporate reorganization. I worked for a summer at Davis Polk after my second year of law school and was lucky enough to work with Stephen Case, who was one of the great bankruptcy lawyers of his generation. And he, first of all, gave me exposure to bankruptcy law and then also enlightened me to the fact that the bankruptcy code was about to be passed. This was the summer of 1977. And that it would be an interesting field to go into because a lot of the old knowledge was going to depreciate very quickly, and it was an opportunity for a young person to get involved. And in fact, Steve asked me during my third year of law school to go to an Aliaba conference on the West Coast, which involved some of the great bankruptcy names like Ron Trost and George Treister and Leon Foreman and Ken Klee. Which I did at Davis Polk's expense. It was really the way they launched me in the bankruptcy field. And when I finally got to the firm, immediately I got involved in bankruptcy matters.
So you were in kind of ongoing touch with them after your summer?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And did you resist it all, or did you think this sounded like a great idea?
Well, during my third year of law school, I was taking bankruptcy from Walter Blum at the University of Chicago, and I was fascinated by the subject. What I realized is that it involves every area of law. It involves litigation, it involves corporate finance, it involves labor, it involves just about everything. And I found that fascinating. And I also found the sort of multilateral zero-sum game aspect of it fascinating as well.
So you managed to achieve a twosome or a duo in terms of mentors to have worked with Steve Case from the beginning on the practice side and to have taken bankruptcy from Walter Blum on the law school side is kind of a dream come true, or would be for most
people. Well, it certainly explains why I am where I am.
It's quite amazing. And I want to talk in a few minutes about the article you've worked on. I'm struck that there are some obvious affinities to the work that Walter Blum was doing 30 or 40 years ago, and in some respects it's a new version of what he was doing a long time ago. But we'll put that off for a couple minutes. Was there a big case that kind of launched your career, or is there a case that comes to mind as the case in your early career at Davis Polk?
Well, I think it was just a series of cases. Davis Polk had in those days an enormous creditor representation practice. Through the early 70s, there weren't that many bankruptcy cases other than the railroad cases that had started in the late 60s, Penn Central, Erie Lackawanna, and the like. And one of the first things I did when I got to Davis Polk was I became involved in the Erie Lackawanna reorganization proceeding. In addition, in 1975, Davis Polk had the good fortune to be representing the lender group for W.T. Graham. So I was able to see a non-railroad corporate bankruptcy as well, although that by the time I arrived, that was already a liquidation.
And some people, and I'm thinking in particular of Harvey Miller, look at W.T. Grant as one of the first cases that launched the modern era in corporate reorganization. I think he identifies that as one of the first cases that really involved a lot of claims trading and a lot of the things we now associate with big Chapter 11 cases. Were there other early cases that were particularly important either to you or to the national practice?
Yeah. Well, I think there were a series of workouts in the early 80s and then one large bankruptcy that I sort of view as in combination as having launched the practice. And the workouts involved Chrysler, International Harvester, and Alice Chalmers Corporation. Those were sort of the big three, which established the out-of-court workout process and involved all of the relevant players, the banks, the insurance companies, the bond traders in those days, and also involved some of the new techniques that were just evolving at the time, which related to capital market strategies for making distributions to creditors. For example, an International Harvester, for the first time, a lender group took equity-related securities in any significant amount, and they were able to do a restructuring around a stapled security, which involved both debt and equity. And that was sort of the precursor to some of the more modern restructuring techniques we see today. And then, of course, in 1982, quite famously, Johns Manville went into Chapter 11, and that was really my first exposure to debtor side work. Steve Case had been a longtime outside counsel for Johns Manville, and together with Michael Cranes of the Levin & Weintraub firm, we, Davis Polk, were a co-counsel in the bankruptcy case for Johns Manville, which was the first great mass tort case.
And I would love to talk about each of those, going back first to the International Harvester issue that you talked about, equity securities that that lenders ended up with. Was this banks that were ending up with these securities?
Yes, it was banks and insurance companies. International Harvester had both parent company and credit company banks. In fact, in many respects, it was structured the way a lot of industrial companies are structured today. And the real problem in that case was that the company needed a conventional recapitalization. And there was very little history prior to that time of doing that sort of recapitalization transaction. The financial advisors there to the bank group proposed a complicated restructuring involving debt and equity securities. And the bank group was willing to do that, and it turned out well for the bank group. In fact, because the securities were designed to be sold in the capital markets, many of the lenders were able to exit from the transaction simply by selling what they got in the restructuring, and really made out quite well.
And that sort of picks up on the question that was puzzling me, and that is my impression has always been that banks don't want to end up with equity and reorganizations because they can't hang on to it. Were they interested? Is that correct, first of all? And second of all, were they willing to go this route because of the likelihood they'd be able to turn around and sell the securities fairly easily?
Well, first of all, banks, when they do a restructuring for debt previously contracted, can hang on to equity for some period of time. So it's not impossible to do. Very often, traditional lenders don't like the balance sheet impact of taking equity because it is difficult to value the realization unless you sell it.
Right.
And that's really the thing that causes the most resistance. But on the other hand, I think faced with the prospect of an almost certain bankruptcy, lenders became receptive in the early 80s to taking equity if they had to. And, they preferred equity, of course, that involved a capital market exit, and usually they were able to design registration rights or some other form of exit strategy that permitted them to sell if they wanted to. So it appealed to those who were willing to retain the equity, and it also appealed to those who wanted to get out very quickly.
In shifting to Johns Manville, which you mentioned as well. I think of Johns Manville as you mentioned, one of the first great mass tort cases and one of the first cases to use a trust arrangement as a way to resolve the claims in the case. Have you had more of those cases? Do people become kind of specialists in a particular kind of reorganization like that, or was it one-off?
You do tend to see those cases again if you've seen them before. I mean, I had a big role in the Dow Corning case in the mid-90s through well past 2000, probably because of my prior involvement in asbestos cases, and we've been involved in a number of other asbestos cases as well. The negotiations with the tort bar in those cases really are the focal point, and I think experience does matter in connection with those negotiations.
One of the issues that's come up recently in those cases is the issue of substantive consolidation, and I don't know, you may have been involved in this, so you may not want to speak to it, but I'd be curious as to where you think that issue is going. There was a big...
Well, I think the Third Circuit's decision recently in Owens Corning has been quite helpful in clarifying that issue. I think there had been some uncertainty as to whether the standards for substantive consolidation had been changing, and I think at least the Third Circuit seems to have restored some balance in that area. There are still other circuits that have different points of view, but the notion that simply because a company has overwhelming liabilities or that they have a traditional consolidated cash management system or other update, they issue consolidated financial statements certainly had never been thought until recently to be earmarks of substantive consolidation. Normally, the idea that companies can have separate corporate existences but still live in a corporate family was the traditional view of the corporate world, and it seems like the Owens Corning decision has sort of reinforced that view and reduced the likelihood that superficial indicia would result in substantive consolidation.
So in a sense, it's consolidated not to make a pot what people thought the law was like generally?
Yes. I think certainly for the Second Circuit and the Third Circuit, that is true.
Another issue or set of issues that I think of as important recent issues is the set of issues that you raised and addressed in the article that you recently wrote with Douglas Baird. And I'm not sure if I have I don't have the published version in front of me, but the working paper version, I think, was called Absolute Priority, Valuation Uncertainty, and the Reorganization Bargain. I can't remember.
Yeah, and the published version has the same title.
So it did not change titles. Could you describe how that article came about and also in a nutshell, a kind of soundbite version of what y'all argue?
Okay. Well, the way it came about was really out of my experience at the very beginning of my career with railroad reorganizations. When Penn Central and the other Northeastern railroads went bankrupt, their assets were taken over and made part of Conrail, and there was, in effect, an eminent domain proceeding before Judge Fulham in Philadelphia to value those assets so that the government could compensate the railroads for the assets that were taken. One of the difficulties in ultimately reorganizing the remaining assets of those railroads was that there was uncertainty over the outcome of the valuation case. Nobody really knew what the ultimate dollar amount would be that would be awarded, and therefore it was very difficult to say which security holders were in the money and which ones were out of the money. And what was done in several of those cases was to create securities with contingent values depending on the outcome of the valuation litigation, so that the value would in effect trickle down to lower parts of the capital structure depending upon the ultimate result of the valuation case. Well, in effect, what was being done there was taking an issue of valuation uncertainty and creating options to address that issue. And I had the opportunity to speak at the American College of Bankruptcy, and I made that point, and I also pointed out that a similar approach could be taken to almost any absolute priority issue, and I used as the example a currently pending case, which was the Conseco Chapter 11. which I was involved in along with Jamie Sprayragan, who was representing the debtor. We happened to be representing the bank group, and there were bondholders at various levels of the capital structure as well. And there was a great deal of difference among the parties over the value of the enterprise. And there were two ways of resolving that difficulty. One is to put it to the judge and wait for the outcome based upon testimony to the judge. And the other way is to build contingencies in the plan, emerge from bankruptcy, and let the market value the company. And that's what I felt was comparable to what had been done in those railroad cases, and I felt it was a very good solution for the Conseco bankruptcy and would permit the company to emerge much more quickly and preserve the value of the company, yet permit the market to say who really was in the money and who was out of the money. It turned out that that solution was adopted in Conseco, and what this article tried to do was lay out the whole valuation uncertainty problem, lay out the possibility that the bankruptcy did not have to be a day of reckoning on the bankruptcy, on the valuation issue, but rather you could take the valuation issue and address it using optional options in connection with your distributions under the plan and permit the parties to get the value that they were entitled to, without having to ask a judge based upon what must be biased valuation testimony from two sides who are diametrically opposed to each other to come up with some sort of valuation.
And had you raised this possibility in the case, or were you just
No. This was already under discussion in the case, and in fact, it had been used in one smaller bankruptcy for La Roche Industries about 2 years before Conseco. So this was, and then also if you look at what was going on in the entire field, you see warrants and other option-type securities being used to settle plan disputes all the time. This is not really a new concept, but I think articulating it in the way we did and pinpointing valuation uncertainty as the reason why junior classes sometimes appear to be participating in bankruptcy cases even when they would otherwise seem to be out of the money, was really where we tried to move things forward in terms of the academic piece.
And is there any resistance to this idea? When you first hear it, it sounds like this is a brilliant solution to what many people think is the most difficult issue in all of bankruptcy. Why not just use this in every reorganization of any size? Is there a sticking point with it so that it works in some cases but not other cases?
Yeah, I think that the sticking point is the parties may have very different perceptions of where the judge is going to come out. So just using an example, if you're the senior creditor and you think the judge is going to come out with a very low valuation, you may pursue litigating valuation rather than settling. If you're a junior creditor and you think you can convince the court to come out with a very high valuation, you may litigate the valuation rather than settling it. And an example of that is Exide Technologies. So sometimes the parties are so adamant about their views of value and so convinced that there's less uncertainty than there really is in the potential outcome that they may conclude not to resolve the issue this way. Sometimes there really isn't uncertainty. Sometimes there, you know, in fact, everybody realizes that a particular class is out of the money. So in those cases, you wouldn't use this solution either.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you've not mentioned this thus far in talking about this article. How did you and Douglas Baird end up writing the article?
Well, Douglas happened to be in the audience at my American College presentation, and he approached me after. Douglas and I had known each other for a long time through various contacts in the bankruptcy world and as well as at the University of Chicago Law School, where he's a professor. And he said to me, gee, I think there may be an article in the ideas that you've just presented. Would you like to write an article with me? To which I responded yes, and it's proof that choosing the right co-author is everything in life.
Oh, this is right. From both of y'all's perspective, I brought that question up in particular in part because it will make every law professor in the country jealous who listens to this, and in part also to just underscore the value of cross-fertilization, of academics being involved in in conferences with bankruptcy lawyers and hopefully vice versa. Because
it was a great privilege, really, to write with Douglas, and there were certain things which really came as it really opened my eyes. One of the issues that I had always been troubled by, and I think may have troubled Douglas also, is why bankruptcies don't always result in an auction. Why isn't that a way of maximizing value? And as we discussed it, I had some concerns about it because my gut, after going through these cases, has told me that the business people really believe that in many cases a sale of the business isn't the right thing to do. And Douglas said, well, you're talking about the lemons problem. And I said, well, what is the lemons problem? And he explained to me the whole academic literature about why automobiles that are driven out of the showroom depreciate in value so much, and the whole question of private information. So that, to me, was very enlightening, and I think it is really part of the reason why there may be something to the notion that the creditors may prefer to own the company than sell it out of a bankruptcy.
And that sort of leads me to the kind of flip side question. If that's the answer, why do we not always have auctions? Is the lemons problem or concerns about the valuation? Why do we ever have auctions? I mean, in what kind of a case are you likely to see an auction, or do the parties are the parties likely to think an auction may work?
Well, I think sometimes you're going to find the parties need to liquefy their positions more quickly than a strategy of owning the company would indicate. I think sometimes, in effect, you're having the auction in a way because the debt is trading in advance. So by the time the reorganization time comes around, in effect, the company has been sold through the trading of the securities. And there are various reasons why you might or might not want to have an auction. And I think in each case, it's going to differ. In some cases, like Adelphia Communications, the feeling was that the way of realizing the highest and best value was to sell and sell at that time. In other cases,
we pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Tuesday in the case of Travelers Casualty and Surety Company of America versus Pacific Gas and Electric Company. The question presented was whether Travelers may collect attorney's fees from PG&E that arose out of a pre-petition contract claim, but that were incurred post-petition. The dispute stems from PG&E's bankruptcy filing in April of 2001. Travelers had provided PG&E with a $100 million bond to cover PG&E's workers' compensation obligations. Travelers filed a claim related to the bond in bankruptcy court, and PG&E subsequently sued Travelers. As a part of a contract providing for the issuance of the bond, PG&E had committed to pay Travelers' attorney's fees in the event of litigation. Travelers sought to recover $167,000 in fees, but PG&E refused. The bankruptcy court denied the claim for attorney's fees, and the Ninth Circuit sided with PG&E in February 2006, citing the rule established in Fobian v. Western Farm Credit Bureau. The court said that because the fees grew out of issues peculiar to federal bankruptcy law, the claim ought to be denied. The Supreme Court granted certiorari to decide whether an unsecured creditor could recover, as a part of its unsecured claim, attorney's fees incurred post-petition that arose out of a pre-petition contract. Travelers' counsel and ABI member Eric Brunstad argued before the justices that the Ninth Circuit's Fobian case wrongly created a federal common law rule governing contracts and the bankruptcy treatment of claims that arise out of them, pointing out that such issues had historically fallen within state law. Under sharp questioning by Justices Kennedy and Breyer, PG&E did not affirmatively defend the Fobian rule, but instead argued that attorneys' fees earned post-petition do not constitute allowed claims under the Bankruptcy Code. Travelers argued before the justices that the Phobian rule should be overturned because it has no basis in federal law and exists outside the structure of the bankruptcy code. A decision is expected at the end of the Supreme Court's term in October. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
Shifting to your role as chair of the National Bankruptcy Conference, and I think I'm correct that you are currently the chair.
I'm current chair.
How long have you been involved in the National Bankruptcy Conference, and what sorts of things are you all focusing on now?
My involvement with the NBC started in the late 1980s. The conference was at that time doing a code review project. It was looking at areas that might be improved in bankruptcy code, and first it created working groups that included non-members of the conference from across the country to participate with the conference in that review, and later on I was named a member of the conference, and that project was completed, I think somewhat before the commission was impaneled. I guess that was in 1994. And several members of the conference were very active on the commission that led up to the 97 commission report. During that period, the conference was very actively looking at how the code might be improved. Since that time, the conference took a very active role and expressed its viewpoint very strongly on the legislation that culminated in the Reform Act recently. There were many provisions in the Reform Act that the conference did not support, especially in the consumer area. But the bill was passed, and I think the conference right now, at least in the near term, is going to be looking at simply technical problems with the bill. The conference really, apart from policy issues, also tries to function to improve the law as it is, and to the extent that the current legislation has problems even in achieving the results it's intending to achieve, the conference is going to look very carefully and try to provide input on those issues so that the technical issues at least can be addressed. I think with the new Congress that's just been elected, obviously the conference will make itself available, as it has for every Congress for the last 75 years, to address policy issues as well. The motto of the conference is that the lawyers and judges and academics, if this is an apt phrase for the academics, try to check their clients or check their philosophies at the door, and we try to come in and we try to look at what's best for the bankruptcy system. It's always been true of the conferees, and we get an extraordinary effort out of very busy people, and we really try to present all sides of an issue. We try to give unbiased views, and we try to do what's best for the system.
One of the things that struck me about some of the developments you've just been talking about is for decades, particularly in the 60s and the 70s, but really going back to the early 30s when the NBC was first formed with all of the kinds of objectives that you've just described to be a source of technical expertise and to kind of caucus with Congress and with the drafters of legislation. For decades, and particularly in the 60s and 70s, there was a sense that Congress was really listening closely to what NBC was saying, and they were working together. And it seemed to me that there was less of that sense this go-round, that Congress kind of was doing its own thing. Has something permanently changed about the politics of bankruptcy, or was 2005 a blip, or what is your sense of that?
Well, I think bankruptcy is much higher on the agenda of many, many, many more interest groups than it was in the 60s or 70s. The period prior to the 60s and 70s was a period, really, of very low bankruptcy activity. If you look at what happened after World War II, it was really a relatively a low-profile endeavor for the period from 1945 until the mid-1970s. I think it really wasn't high on the interest meter. Today, that's entirely different. Creditors are very focused on bankruptcy. I think as well the public is focused on bankruptcy, and there are two very strong and different groups of interest groups who take either pro-creditor or pro-debtor positions, and their voices are heard in Congress much, much more actively than they were in the past. I think the NBC can provide a useful sounding board really articulate what the true consequences of the different partisan positions are. And one of the roles that I envision the NBC playing is a role of sifting out all of these positions and trying to help Congress understand what the consequences, both intended and unintended, are of each of the positions.
And would you interact with the interest groups on this level, or is your primary focus on talking to Congress and talking to the staffs of people involved in the legislative process?
Well, our primary focus is on articulating our positions and to make those positions available to Congress. The conferees and the conference have broad involvement outside of their conference activities with a whole range of interest groups. So many of the conferees bring those perspectives to bear in the deliberation that occurs at the conference. But we also have been making an effort in recent years to reach out to other groups, to reach out to other constituencies. And I think in the long run, it's important because I think there is some polarization, and perhaps the conference can play a role in reducing the polarization and furthering the cause of improvement of the system.
Shifting gears a little bit, one of the issues that everybody seems to be focusing on in the large reorganization cases now and the could-be reorganization cases is the role of hedge funds. How have they changed the process in your experience? And do you have any predictions as to where they're going and where the process is going?
I think the hedge funds have changed the process quite drastically. I think that by their willingness to buy into bank debt positions, and in fact their willingness to participate in initial bank syndicates, you've got a new group of players in these cases who are more willing to view both senior and junior debt positions as investments as opposed to traditional loans, and they're willing to buy and sell those positions or hold on to those positions over the long term depending on their value. And so rationality and predictability has been brought to the process in a strange way, although some might disagree with me about that. But I think that the fact that these investors are viewing every level of the capital structure the way an investor does, as opposed to the way a traditional lender does, has brought a certain predictability to the process that didn't exist before. Now, they've also brought unpredictability in the sense that you can be negotiating a restructuring and then have the players change because that changes hands. That can be extremely frustrating to the professionals involved. But I am optimistic that the hedge fund phenomenon actually is an advancement in our insolvency system, because the players who are ultimately at the table when things come to rest are players who are viewing the situation in a very open-minded way and are willing to explore alternatives, including continuing to own the company that others might not have explored in the past. Now, it's interesting to think about where things may be headed. What I have seen is more of the hedge fund investors being willing to take a long-term view and view these situations as private equity type investments rather than simply trading positions. And as I say, I think that's a positive development. I think that they, by taking a long-term view, make the decision as to whether it's better to reorganize or better to sell the enterprise better to develop some other solution, a more rational one. And they also are interested in resolving these matters relatively quickly and moving on to the next matter rather than dragging them out. Now, there are always exceptions to this. There are always going to be players who want to hold things up simply to extract an added pound of flesh, as it were. But I don't think we can avoid that, and I think we have to rely on the bankruptcy courts to have the discipline, the self-discipline, to address those situations as they arise.
One of the things that a number of us on the academic side, including your co-author Douglas Baer, have been writing about in recent years is the increase in creditor control, of which obviously hedge funds are a huge part, but also the role of debtor-in-possession financiers in controlling cases. Has hedge funds complicated that, or are hedge funds becoming debtor-in-possession financiers, or how is that interaction working out?
Yeah, I think hedge funds are doing all of the things that traditional lenders have done in the past, including offering debtor-in-possession financing. So that is clearly true. And I am somewhat more skeptical of the idea that debtor-in-possession financing lenders are controlling these cases. My experience has not been that the debtor-in-possession lender is controlling the case. I think it is true that senior creditors, with their rights to adequate protection and the like, have a certain amount of control in these cases simply because very often the cases are either cash flow insolvent or administratively insolvent, and the senior creditor position as a consequence of the adequate protection requirement exercises a great deal of control through the need to get their consent to use cash collateral. But that, I think, is a function today of the fact that many companies that go into bankruptcy are so over-leveraged that the senior creditor is in that position. I don't think that's a function of the fact that debtor-in-possession financings are particularly onerous. And in fact, usually the debtor-in-possession lenders design the financings to give the companies the opportunity to reorganize. And it's really the pre-petition secured creditors who, through their rights to adequate protection and the like, are asserting the limitations on the debtor. So I'm skeptical of that notion. But hedge funds are directly involved in all of that.
And in one more very much related question, another thing that comes up a lot, at least in my conversations with the bankruptcy bar, is second liens and the role they've played in a dozen or so cases in the last couple of years, which second lien holders often are hedge funds. Do second liens seem to be changing the process a great deal, or are second liens ultimately just a fancy form of subordinated debt?
I believe, frankly, that the second lien positions, these second lien positions are increasingly common. They're going to be issues in more and more cases during the next cycle because so many companies have been financed using the vehicle of second lien structures. Initially, when those structures were proposed, they were supposed to be so-called silent second liens. The documentation has evolved in a way that makes them somewhat less silent. And even where the liens are silent, it's been my view that very often the second lien security is going to be the so-called fulcrum security in the case, namely the security that's likely to end up with the common stock in the case. And as a consequence of that, the likelihood is that they will get the attention of management, they will get the attention of the debtor in possession, and many of the restrictions that those securities operate under will become irrelevant because of their central role in the plan negotiations being the fulcrum security. and the debtors and the other parties in interest will have to do what needs to be done to bring those constituencies along. Now, maybe that's a long way of saying, in some respects, you're right. The fact that these security holders have a second lien is not as relevant, and it is, in many respects, similar to the position of subordinated debt, which can be the fulcrum security in any of these cases as well.
Is there any, this is sort of re-asking the same question, and you could just answer no or yes if you want, but is there any difference between the two? Is there anything you have as a second lien holder that you would not have had as someone with subordinated debt in a case where you're fairly clearly this is the fulcrum security?
Well, yes and no. As a secured creditor, at least under the statute, you have rights to adequate protection of your lien position to the extent there's diminution of value. In many of these second lien documents, however, the second lien holder purports to give up the right to assert that adequate protection position. And one of the key issues in the cases that will undoubtedly unfold over the next few years is whether some of those waivers of rights are going to be enforced during the bankruptcy case.
And they have not yet been...
they haven't been fully litigated to this point.
And that's interesting. Just a couple more questions, and then I'll let you go. And these have to do with the 2005 changes we were talking about earlier. On the corporate reorganization side, a couple of the changes that have gotten a lot of attention are the restrictions on exclusivity and the restrictions on so-called pay-to-stay bonuses for executives. First, with the exclusivity restrictions, do they seem to be having a great deal of bite in the big cases, or is your guess they'll be worked around?
Well, 18 months have not passed yet since the enactment
of the legislation. Yeah, so I guess it's hard to tell.
So we don't know yet what impact they're going to have. It is true that many of the cases are now being resolved in far less than that 18-month period. And it is also true that while a lifting of exclusivity permits other plans to be filed, it is not such an easy thing to file a plan and to do a disclosure statement without the debtor's cooperation. So it's going to be very interesting to see, at least in larger cases, that pass that 18-month deadline, whether there's going to be any real impact of the termination of exclusivity at that point.
Is the difficulty the cost of putting together the disclosure statement or the difficulty of valuation? Where does the problem arise?
Well, there are several problems. The first problem is you have to have a business plan in order to have a plan of reorganization. So the first question is, do you have a credible business plan without the debtor? Or maybe you do. Maybe you've got the debtor's business plan and you can work off of that. But the second question is, you also need to have a confirmable plan. And that means the entire negotiation has to take place in order for you to have a plan that's confirmable, either based on consent of the various impaired classes or based on cram down. But even if you get that far, you then have to put together credible disclosure. You have to do a liquidation analysis. You've got to have all the things that are necessary for a complete disclosure statement. And, a disclosure statement for a big case is like an S-1 registration statement, and you've got to be privy to a lot of inside information about the company. Now, after exclusivity is lifted, courts may well allow access to various parties to pursue pulling together a disclosure statement, or could order debtors to put out a pro forma disclosure statement that could be used by various parties. But on the other hand, courts may be reluctant to make it too easy for people to file alternative plans, because if you get multiple competing plans, the process could break down.
Yeah, that's interesting. And on the executive compensation side, is there a sense that debtors and their counsel and creditors' lawyers are going to work around the limits on stay bonuses, or is that still in flux, or what's the word on the street about that?
There have been a few cases where alternative types of bonus arrangements have been used rather than retention payments. And at least in a couple of cases, that strategy appears to have been successful. The difficulty is, on the one hand, in a bankruptcy context where everybody is taking pain, some of the awards of retention bonuses in the past have seemed excessive. And the flip side, obviously, is the need to meet the market to retain your employees. And in a troubled situation where there is a risk that the business may not ultimately be reorganized, it is potentially difficult to retain employees without compensating them to meet their needs. So this is a very, very difficult issue. Since the passage of the legislation, it seems like companies that have gone into Chapter 11, the few large ones at least that I've been observing, have been able to keep their employees and have been able to fashion something. The initial attempts have sometimes been rejected by the courts as violating the new statute, but they seem to be able to come up with alternatives that the courts are then willing to validate. So I don't think it so far has been a big problem, and it looks to me like there are ways of compensating employees to retain them despite the limitations that have been added to the statute.
And as my final question, I'll ask the most unfair question of all, but everybody asks it, and that is, do you expect to see a wave of big bankruptcies in the next 6 months or year, or are we going to keep kind of moving around at the pace?
Well, if you keep extending the period to 2 years or 3 years, eventually there'll be a change in the cycle. It's extremely hard to predict. In today's world, with the potential event risk that's out there, with the uncertainty over where the economy is headed and the like, with the uncertainty over whether the flood of capital that's been available for the last few years will continue to be available to permit companies to do refinancings that might otherwise be unable to refinance their debt, it's almost impossible to predict. And I think if you ask five people, you'll get five different answers. Some of the insolvency professionals may view it as optimistic to say that it's going to be sooner rather than later. My personal view is whatever is best for the economy is best for all of us, so I'm not terribly anxious for there to be a spate of failures in the short run.
That's a wonderful note on which to end. Thank you.